From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talked to a former Army interrogator about the techniques he used to get information about Al-Qaeda from prisoners in Afghanistan. Chris Mackey was sent to Afghanistan in the fall of 2001 and supervised interrogations at Bagram Airfield. He's written a new book called The Interrogators. We'll also meet his co-author, Greg Miller, national security correspondent for the LA Times. Mackey says he was stunned and disgusted to learn about the abuses at Abu Ghraib. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews PJ Harvey's new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraqi militants have released a Filipino hostage after his country withdrew the last of its 51 soldiers from Iraq. Filipino truck driver Angelo De La Cruz was reported to be in good condition at the Philippine embassy in Baghdad. The Philippine president dismissed U.S. and Australian criticism of her decision, saying it reflects her concerns for millions of Filipinos who work overseas. The Senate Intelligence Committee has begun hearings on ways to restructure the CIA and the nation's other spy services. Today, senators grilled witnesses on the wisdom of creating a new Director of National Intelligence. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports.
Committee Chairman Pat Roberts opened the hearing with an acknowledgement that Congress has tried to reform the intelligence community before, creating new positions, moving resources around, and cutting programs.
We have not, however, undertaken a major reexamination of the intelligence community's mission and structure. That effort starts today.
On Thursday, the 9/11 Commission is expected to back creating a so-called intelligence czar, and several senators indicated they might support the idea. But they also asked hard questions about whether it could create more problems than it solves, and they queried whether the job would need to be at cabinet level. Both the CIA and the Pentagon opposed the idea. President Bush says he's reserving judgment until he sees the 9/11 panel's recommendations. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan said today that he's optimistic that the economy will keep growing despite a slowdown in recent weeks. Greenspan told the Senate Banking Committee that so far this year, economic conditions have been quite favorable. He said some prices have risen, but he doesn't believe that inflation is a serious threat yet. President Bush is campaigning in the Midwest today. From member station WSUI, Dean Borg reports on the president's stop in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Responding to re-election chants, President Bush made a promise.
4 more years and America will be safer and the world will be more peaceful.
Mr. Bush said a lesson from 9/11 is that a threat must be dealt with before it materializes.
We've done the hard work, and there's more hard work to do. But this world is a more peaceful world, and when you give me 4 more years, it's going to be more peaceful than it is today. We're making progress.
The president took some impromptu questions from his audience. 4 years ago, Mr. Bush lost Iowa by a little more than 4,000 votes. Today, he went on to campaign in another swing state, Missouri. For NPR News, I'm Dean Borg in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 55 points to close at 10,149. The Nasdaq was up 33 to 1917. This is NPR News. European Union antitrust regulators have approved the merger of 2 of the 5 remaining major record labels, Sony and the Bertelsmann Music Group. NPR's Rick Carr reports.
EU regulators at first took a dim view of the proposal, as did independent labels and the other 3 majors. But yesterday, the European Commission gave a green light to the deal. If the U.S. Federal Trade Commission approves the merger as expected, which could happen as early as today, Sony BMG would become the world's 2nd largest record label, just behind Vivendi Universal. The new label would control nearly a quarter of the worldwide music market. It's expected to lay off thousands of staff. Executives at Sony and BMG argue that new technologies and a changing retail marketplace left them no alternative but to merge. The deal does not include the music publishing divisions of Sony or Bertelsmann, the divisions that own copyrights on musical compositions. Unlike the record business, the publishing industry has been growing. Rick Carr, NPR News.
Senate Democrats have blocked President Bush's nominee to a federal appeals court. Democrats say William Myers lacks judicial experience, but does have a long record of opposing environmental protection when he was a lawyer and lobbyist for grazing and mining interests. He's also opposed by environmental and Native American groups. Republicans say Myers is qualified and that Democrats are simply trying to obstruct the president's judicial nominees. Myers is the seventh of President Bush's judicial nominees to face a Democratic filibuster. Democrats, however, point out that the Senate has confirmed 198 of the president's nominees to the federal bench. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 8 points to close at 1107. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Chris Mackey, was an Army interrogator in Afghanistan who had to decide how far to go to get information from prisoners. He says when he learned of the abuses at Abu Ghraib, he was stunned, sickened, and angry. Mackey was deployed to Afghanistan in the fall of 2001 and became the supervisor of all military interrogations conducted at the detention facility at Bagram Airfield. His unit was not technically bound by the Geneva Conventions because the Bush administration had ruled that the prisoners were unlawful combatants. Nevertheless, according to Mackey, his unit understood from the beginning that they were to behave as if the conventions did apply. Mackey was a reservist who had joined the military in 1989 at the age of 17. He's written a new book called The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda. His co-author, Greg Miller, who is also with us, is a national security correspondent for the LA Times. He reported from Bagram Airfield and interviewed other interrogators from Mackey's unit. By the way, Chris Mackey is a pseudonym. The former Army sergeant avoided using his real name for security reasons. Chris, one of the things you say in the book is that one of the most interesting documents to surface from the Abu Ghraib investigation is a one-page sheet outlining the interrogation rules of engagement. And you say on the left side of the page is a list of the 16 standard interrogation approaches. On the right side is a list of 9 additional techniques that require prior approval, including the use of military dogs, sleep deprivation for up to 72 hours, sensory deprivation, and stress positions for as long as 45 minutes at a time. What did you find so interesting about this document?
When I was in Afghanistan, we never operated with these additional sets of rules. We were armed with the interrogation approach strategies that we had been taught in school. And although these certainly did evolve in order to accommodate the cultural issues and a lot of the realities that we encountered on the ground, we never had sort of envisioned the idea that there were a whole other set of rules. We never formalized these. We certainly did have techniques that evolved while we were there, but we never formalized these or had a that level of oversight. We were really self-policing.
You found ways of bending the rules a little bit so that you could do things slightly more severe than the rule book specified. Like you say, with sleep deprivation, the techniques got more lenient for the interrogators as time went on. What were some of the changes that happened under your watch?
When we first got to Afghanistan, we were confronted with an ideologically steeled enemy that was not reacting at all. In fact, was easily thwarting the techniques that we had learned that were principally dedicated towards getting members of the Warsaw Pact to cooperate with us. And so we had to come up with ideas that were going to evolve those strategies in a way that was still consistent with the conventions, but then would become more effective. So one of the things that we did was sort of get very much more sophisticated ruses, very much more sophisticated trickery. And these were the main thrust of how we had new takes on things. But we also flirted with things like modified form of sleep deprivation. And specifically, that was the idea that you could have one interrogator speaking with one prisoner. And as long as that interrogator wasn't tag-teamed out, as long as that interrogator was opposing a single prisoner and they had the same breaks and the same schedule, that would be a good measure to ensure that it didn't violate the Geneva Convention's prohibition on coercion. Of course, the main thrust of the conventions is that you never treat someone in any way that might be compared unfavorably with your own soldiers. So the longest we ever did that was for about, I don't know, maybe 26 or 27 hours, and I probably did that in about 13 or 14 times, and that was the longest.
Did you ever participate in one of those marathon interrogations?
I supervised all the marathon interrogations.
So you were awake for the 24 to 26 hours, too?
Yes, I was. It was one of the reasons why we didn't use this technique very often was because it was so debilitating on our own troops. You have to understand that when prisoners were in the holding facility, they could basically do whatever they wanted for the entire 24 hours a day unless they were being questioned. Interrogators, on the other hand, had maybe 15, 16 hours of straight interrogations to go through and then had to write reports after that and still had military responsibilities to tend to. So the opportunity to question somebody for a longer period of time, we felt, was just trying to even up some of the odds. But at the same time, we realized that we had to be very, very careful and not cross over the line of the conventions. And that was sort of the sharpest arrow in our quiver.
Greg Miller, you're the national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. How much time did you spend in Afghanistan, and how closely were you able to actually see what happened during interrogations?
Well, I was there, I think, all of 2 weeks, and while I was there, interviewed Chris and a number of his colleagues in the unit. That's how we met. And actually, I was never allowed inside the facility. All of the interviews were conducted at another facility on the base, under supervision of military minders or Chris's superior officers there. And so it was only a very partial glimpse into what was happening inside the prison at Bagram Air Base when I was there. The press tent that they had set up for us was just around the backside of it, so we sort of stared at it and looked at it all day, but you could never see inside it, never really knew what was happening in there, and I can't recall ever seeing even prisoners delivered there because they were brought in on another side to which nobody had access.
And Greg, how confident are you that you really have a complete picture of a really closed system? I mean, you never got inside the system, so you're relying on what people told you.
That's right. My confidence stems from the amount of time that I've spent with Chris and other members of his unit talking with them. I don't have any firsthand knowledge of what happened inside this place. I am only relaying what I'm told from others, and their stories are very consistent. And I think if you spend time with these people, these interrogators who worked at Bagram, you can't help but see that that they took their job very seriously, and they saw their upholding of the principles of the conventions as the most important thing in their job. Terry, I should add, I mean, obviously, human rights organizations and a number of prisoners have come out of Bagram and the prison at Guantanamo Bay and said that they were abused. And we tried to handle that in this book by including some of the materials from some of the Human Rights Watch organizations that have interviewed these prisoners. We don't. I'd be the last person to dismiss what these prisoners have to say. And obviously, Abu Ghraib has showed us that horrible things can happen in an American-run facility.
Chris Mackey, you write that a lot of people say we shouldn't use torture because it doesn't work. You say that's not necessarily true. We shouldn't use torture because it's wrong. It dehumanizes us. It undermines our cause. But you're implying here that harsh techniques can actually be pretty effective.
I would say that after our experience, the reflection that we had was when we went up to the very edge of what we thought we could do, and I think in retrospect, it seems sort of unintentionally enlightened what we thought was the very precipice of how far we could go. We were getting the best results when it came down to trying to break somebody who was very, very important, who had a lot of information, and who had sort of a a knowledge that would be able to save the lives of American soldiers or help strategically in the war on terror, when we went to the very edge of what we thought was legitimate and that we could do with good consciences.
Can you give me an example of a technique that qualifies as being on the edge that got results?
We tell the story in the book of a case of a prisoner who was basically holding a huge, had in his compound in Afghanistan a bunch of poison called ricin, which is something like anthrax. And we questioned this guy, and of course he came back with this sort of the resistance techniques that we saw all the time, which was sort of the blatant denial of the obvious. You know, it wasn't my house and things like that. And of course all the other people were telling us it was his house. And, you know, there was a lot of information that suggested that this guy was a really bad guy. And that was the guy that we exercised the longest interrogation that we ever did, that 27 or 26-hour interrogation. And an extraordinary interrogator called Fitzgerald in the book conducted that interrogation, and we were able to get information out of that prisoner, which enabled us to make some great strides and to eliminate that very, really detrimental, very dangerous threat.
Now, what are considered stress positions? This is an expression we've all learned from the Abu Ghraib story. What were considered stress positions when you were doing interrogations, and what were your rules about that?
Well, it's important to know that under the conventions, this is something that's not really talked about very much, but it ought to be, that under the conventions, if you're a person who's seeking the protection of the conventions, you also have responsibilities under the conventions. One of them is to obey the lawful orders of your captors. And in respect to that, the captors have a responsibility to keep good order and discipline in the camp. And when prisoners would get out of hand, for example, you know, spit at someone or simply refuse to move, you know, do something lawful, like move from one point of the camp to the other to take a shower. Or in our case, when they would shout or throw a chair or something in the interrogation during the questioning, they engage in something. The MPs or the interrogators would engage in something called a stress position, which is something that we use in, like, basic training in the Army, where you hold your hands above your head or you kneel on the floor and put your arms out. In our case, we never did this for more than what you would get in basic training, maybe 10 or 15 minutes at the most, mainly because we had no recourse. If the prisoner refused to do it, there was no way to force him to continue to do it, and you could really lose a lot of credibility. We were lucky that the prisoners were, you know, generally had somewhere lurking in the back of their minds that they were very, very fearful that something worse would happen to them, even though the actual fact is nothing could. And they usually complied with, you know, knocking out some push-ups or something, which was, you know, in the end, it may seem a little absurd because we had to teach them how to do the push-ups before we could ask them to do them.
Is nudity considered a stress position?
No, I've read about this in the newspapers, and I think Greg will confirm the fact that when we were talking to both, when he was speaking with me and with the other interrogators, we just don't understand quite how this evolved as a technique for interrogation. We would hold, when prisoners first came in, they might have been they were of course given a doctor's visit, and they had their photograph taken, and they might have been during that doctor's visit might have been naked for a few minutes, but the concept of having somebody naked as a humiliation technique or a technique to help progress the questioning, I just don't understand it, and we certainly never practiced it.
And you didn't use dogs for interrogations?
No, it's funny that would come up, because the idea was proposed while we were there. One of the MPs said, hey, you know, these guys are really terrified of dogs. You really should consider that. And that sparked off an intense debate among the interrogators. You know, we were there was only about 7 or 8 of us in this prison, and we were considering this proposal, and we were not unanimous in our decision, but the end, what we came to was there was no way that we could use this without the violation of the rules of coercion that are prescribed in the convention. So we declined to use that. I don't know why exactly or how exactly. Much smarter people than I am came to the conclusion that that was okay, but at the time we thought that that was beyond the pale.
My guests are former Army interrogator Chris Mackey and LA Times national security correspondent Greg Miller. Their new book is called The Interrogators. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Chris Mackey and Greg Miller. They collaborated on the new book, The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda. Sergeant Chris Mackey was the head of interrogations at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, and Greg Miller is national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Chris, you say the Army manual is explicit on torture, the use of force, mental torture, threats, insults, or exposure to unpleasant and inhumane treatment of any kind is prohibited by law and is neither authorized nor condoned by the government. But you also say that the manual tiptoes around what is allowed by saying that the use of force should not be confused with psychological ploys, verbal trickery, or other nonviolent and non-coercive ruses used by the interrogator in questioning hesitant or uncooperative sources. What are some of the deceptions or psychological ruses that you used that seem to be effective in getting information?
On one occasion, which is described in the book, we wrote up an entire newspaper article which suggested that we were setting up terrorist courts in the United States, and these terrorist courts had already condemned three well-known prisoners to death for their roles in the 9/11 attacks. And when we sort of set this in a very realistic-looking frame of an internet for the Los Angeles Times, as a matter of fact. And I don't know how we came up with that idea, but anyway, we brought that newspaper in and gave it to a prisoner, and he was so scared that he actually was sick, so physically sick. So we used to come up with as many clever things as we possibly could to try to unsettle or create anxiety in prisoners that would help us. But we had to be always careful about the so-called dagger on the table, which was a prohibition to actually threaten the lives of prisoners. Like, for instance, if you don't cooperate, I'm going to kill you. That was always, you could never, ever come even close to that. So we had to make sure that we were staying on the right side of the rules, but anything that we could do for sophisticated tricks was always on our minds, always trying to evolve new ideas.
Greg Miller is a national security correspondent for the LA Times. How do you feel about the ruse that Chris just mentioned, where they wrote up a false story, false newspaper story, saying that prisoners had been court-martialed and sentenced to death, implying that, you know, if you don't give information, you might be sentenced to death too?
Well, it's a method that's it's sort of not explicitly sanctioned in the Army Field Interrogation Manual, but it's sort of alluded to in the language in that manual that suggests that that sort of trickery is within the rules. I'm not sure as a journalist how I feel about having my newspaper become an instrument of that. On the other hand, it certainly was effective. There's another elaborate ruse that we describe in the book in some detail, and one of the members of Chris's unit spoke fluent Arabic, was from an Arab Gulf state, and could pass himself off as an Egyptian or a member of another Gulf state. And at one point, Chris and other members of the unit set up a staged an event, basically, on the prison floor, where they had this interrogator posing as an officer from an Arab military force who was coming to fetch some prisoners and take back to his home country. Well, many of the prisoners in the compound would certainly know what would be in store for them if that were really the case. And so they started pulling prisoners out of the cages one by one and putting duct tape across their chests, saying this so-and-so is bound for this country and so-and-so is bound for X country, making the prisoners believe that they were being prepared for transport to a state where it's widely known that they would be tortured. And in the end of the chapter, we describe the aftermath of this. I mean, that night, a number of prisoners come to the edges of the cages. They know they're supposed to get on a plane the next morning. They come to the edge of the cages, holding their bellies and pretending to be sick, just so they can be let out, so they can try to shed whatever shreds of information they have left in a last-ditch effort to come clean and avoid that fate. In fact, there never was that option. This was just another plane that was bound for Guantanamo. But that's the sort of elaborate ruse that they were coming up with, the sort of psychological ploy to trick prisoners into thinking that they were bound for a truly harrowing ordeal.
Chris, did you have brainstorming sessions where you'd sit around and come up with creative ruses that might be effective in tricking people into giving up information?
We did. We developed a standardized format where every morning and every evening all the interrogators would get together, discuss what they had learned from the prisoners, discuss what was working in the booth in the room where we were questioning them, and what was not working. And we would also brainstorm ways to overcome people who were reluctant to speak. And those discussions were always actually very entertaining, as people came up with sometimes pretty outlandish ideas about how they might be able to convince somebody to cooperate with us.
And Terry, in fact, this is Greg, that ruse we just described about having staging an event on the prison floor to make a large number of prisoners believe that they were going to be transported to Egypt or some other country, that was the result of one of those brainstorming sessions. And in fact, it came at the end of, it was heavily orchestrated, where it started 5 or 6 days earlier with just the delicate sort of planting of rumors in the cages, using snitches and using cooperative prisoners as well as the MPs to plant rumors in the cages that this sort of thing was coming, that a colonel from a Gulf state was coming to look over the prisoners. And it was sort of obviously very carefully cultivated, this fear, and it built up over a period of 5 or 6 days and culminates in this event on the prison floor that sends many of the prisoners into a state of panic.
Well, Chris Mackey, when you are able to get a prisoner to become a snitch or an informant or to help you spread a rumor, or if you just get them to give up information and confess, can you offer protection so that they are not attacked by fellow prisoners?
Well, we took measures to ensure that it was very difficult for anyone to ever know who was being cooperative. For example, we would take prisoners that we weren't even speaking to up into the interrogation rooms and just have them sit there with an MP or with an interrogator who was just reading a book for a couple of hours, just so that everybody was being rotated through. We wanted to make sure that if we had people that we were speaking to routinely because they were cooperating, we wanted to make sure that they didn't appear among their fellows to be cooperative. It would be detrimental to us and to them. So everything that we could do to camouflage those who were being helpful was useful. We also used sort of an inverted part of that as a method to get people to talk. If we had somebody who was very resistant to questioning and who was being very uncooperative, we would simply bring them up once or twice a day for a couple of hours so that it looked like they were being cooperative to their peers.
Chris Mackey is a former Army interrogator. Greg Miller is a national security correspondent for the LA Times. Their new book is called The Interrogators. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, tips from an Al-Qaeda manual about how to thwart U.S. interrogators. We continue our conversation with former Army interrogator Chris Mackey and journalist Greg Miller, authors of the book The Interrogators. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD from PJ Harvey.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Chris Mackey and Greg Miller, the authors of the new book, The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda. Mackey is a former Army interrogator who was sent to Afghanistan in the fall of 2001 and supervised interrogations at the detention facility at Bagram Airfield. Miller is a national security correspondent for the LA Times. Chris Mackey, you say that in Afghanistan you found an Al-Qaeda, not you personally, but an Al-Qaeda manual was found that trained its members to resist interrogation from the Americans. What were some of the things that you learned from this manual about the techniques that some of your prisoners would be using to resist your interrogation techniques?
Well, for us, it was kind of like capturing the other team's playbook. We began to translate this document that came in on a so-called site exploitation by the special forces, and they were coming in routinely with huge, huge bags full of materials. You know, some of it was absolutely useless, and some of it was hugely valuable. And sifting through it became one of the banes of our existence because of the effort that it took to translate all that material. One day, we pulled out from this huge stack of paperwork this manual, and discovered that it was, in fact, the part of their very programized, very, very sophisticated classroom training for resistance to interrogation. And although it's really concentrated more on what they might expect from Gulf states or from North Africa or from the Levant, had they been detained or questioned by the authorities in those countries, it did also have information about what to expect if you were questioned by the Americans. The techniques that they described in there were, you know, more or less on the money. They said that the Americans will not hurt you, but you have to be prepared to try to bait them into hitting you and things like this in order to create outrage. And some of the other things that they were saying were right on the money and things that we could actually trace directly to what we had been facing in the early months and days of our operations there. For example, using only the Muslim dates on the calendar so that no interrogator could create a good timeline unless they had a notebook with all of those dates so they could quickly translate it into the Gregorian calendar. Everyone was always telling us that they didn't know absolutely anyone by their actual names and that only their kunyas, or sort of nom de guerre, was made known to them. So every single method that they could use to slow down, to prevent us from the quick acquisition of knowledge, or to simply confuse us, was part of their techniques, and it worked in the early days. It was only after we had been there a few months that we became conversant in, for example, the Muslim calendar, or began to really understand the significance of someone's kunya before we were able to make progress and make quick progress with prisoners.
Now, some of your prisoners turned out to truly just be farmers who they didn't know anything. They weren't the enemy of the United States. At what point could you say to yourself confidently, this person is not a threat to us, we should let this person go?
It was a very difficult thing to arrive at a conclusion like that. But I think that there's a popular image that we would rather have kept people than not, and that isn't true. I mean, we're especially a bunch of reservists and National Guardsmen. We have no incredibly firm ideological commitment to this concept that we are always right. We realize because of our own, you know, we're not so close to the military all the time that we were perfectly aware that we might have made a mistake, and we wanted to try to set those things right. We wanted to return people who had no business in that prison as quickly as we could, not just because it was the right thing to do, but also because we knew that it was something that could only help promote our cause in the end, to get the innocent out of there as quickly as possible. But making the decision was very hard. In the early days at Kandahar, we had a terrible time trying to determine who was who, because they all had stories that were identical. The people who were the worst of the worst would get to Cuba, and eventually we'd find out by a message that they would relay to us that, hey, this guy that you said was a low-level fighter was in fact really, really important. That was very humiliating for us. Fortunately, it didn't happen too often. But the ability to try to screen prisoners, the ability to try to separate the innocent from the guilty, was a preoccupation that we had, and not something that we got good at until much later in our term there.
So your options were keep interrogating the prisoner, send them home, send them to Guantanamo for further interrogation, or were there other options too?
Well, in the early days, if someone fell into one of about four or five categories, we really didn't have an option what to do with them. They were simply caught in the system and they went back. they went on to Cuba. And other times when we had prisoners that we thought that we were on the verge of breaking or we had broken and that they were cooperating and providing good information, we wanted to delay their transport onto Cuba. And we couldn't do that because of the, once they were on that list, it was impossible to get them off. Later on, towards the spring of 2002, we started to develop a system in cooperation with the broader army and the provost marshal's office and other folks to have an outlet for people that we could quickly get them out of the system, get them out of the red tape, and get them home. So those were not our only options, but they were certainly the we had more options as time went on.
Let me just add something, Terry. This is Greg. I spoke with some of the officers who were in Kuwait who were sort of running the ground war in Afghanistan at the time and others at the Pentagon, as well as some of the officers at Kandahar and Bagram while Chris was there. And they all talk about how there was a great fear among them, those who were going to be putting their signatures to the releases of prisoners, great fear that they were going to somehow manage to release somebody who would later turn out to be the 20th hijacker. So there was real concern and a real erring on the conservative side, especially early in the war.
Some of the interrogators at Abu Ghraib were hired through private military contractors. They were civilians. Were there any civilians in your operation, Chris Mackey?
That was a concept that we were very unfamiliar with, and when I read it in the newspapers, I was surprised to see that they had elected to use civilian contractors. I did know that some kind of arrangement had been made in Guantanamo, which I can, just seemed like it was a rear echelon enough environment that would be okay, or at least more understandable. When we were in Afghanistan, we only had civilians who were translators, volunteers who came over to help us with Pashto or Dari.
Chris, I'm going to ask you, if you could, to tell us the story of one prisoner who you interrogated or whose interrogation you oversaw, and what they were like when you first met them and what the turning point was in which they started to give you important information.
A prisoner that we spoke to try to describe one example, we ran into a prisoner who came into custody in probably late January, who was an Algerian but had lived most of his life in Germany. And because I have two languages, I was taught German and Arabic by the Army, I thought that I might have a chance to use the better of the two. My German was quite good, to go in and talk to this prisoner. And we first met one another while he was being in-processed, and then subsequently I was assigned to his case. And he had a real he was well-trained in that Al-Qaeda manual, although at the time I didn't know it. He wouldn't answer any questions directly. He couldn't remember any dates. He used everybody's kunya rather than their actual name, and all dates were given to me in the Islamic calendar. So it wasn't until the very end of a very long interrogation, which at that time was about 6 hours. Most interrogations at that point were only going an hour or two. At the end of a six-hour interrogation, just by complete accident, I asked him a question in Arabic rather than in German, the language in which we had been speaking the entire time. And he dropped a real name. He dropped a name that was actually useful to us. And the two of us looked at each other. We were absolutely shocked. And I think that was another moment as the Al-Qaeda, the discovery of the Al-Qaeda interrogation manual, the resistance to interrogation manual was. It was another moment where sort of the veil of ignorance was lifted. And I realized that, my God, we can actually work with these people. We can actually, they are not perfect. And we can break through this wall of silence. Later on, the discussions that we had were growing in their rapport. We were growing in their success, and after a while, we actually developed kind of a relationship, this guy and I, and we were able to discover some fairly important information about his time in, for instance, Hamburg, where he knew some of the 9/11 hijackers on Marienstrasse in Hamburg. And this discussion was fairly fruitful, and I thought that I had really gotten to the bottom of this guy's case, and I was really pleased with myself that I had persuaded somebody who was, had some very good insight into things as important as the 9/11 hijacking, all the way down to some ideas of where some escape routes might be of foreign fighters who were trying to get out of Afghanistan even in January. Then about a month and a half later, one of the interrogators who worked with me came in and said, "I'd like to have a word with that German, that Algerian German." And before you know it, I was struck with the unfortunate realization that I had only really peeled back one or two layers of this guy's sort of enigmatic onion, and in fact, the guy had a much larger role, and their interrogation, which was more vigorous, although certainly not physical, actually revealed much more valuable information than I ever got. And it was an unfortunate realization for me.
My guests are former Army interrogator Chris Mackey and LA Times national security correspondent Greg Miller. They've written a new book called The Interrogators. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Chris Mackey, who supervised Army interrogations of prisoners at Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan, and Greg Miller, a national security correspondent for the LA Times. Their new book is called The Interrogators. The picture that you both paint of the interrogations at Bagram Air Force Base Detention Center, where Chris Mackey, you oversaw interrogations, is the picture of people kind of working really hard to get information, trying to work within the guidelines, and muddling through and doing their best. A very different picture than the one that has emerged from Abu Ghraib. And I'm wondering how you think the Abu Ghraib story is going to affect future interrogations, both American interrogations of prisoners and other people's interrogations of Americans.
Well, I guess I would say two things. The only silver lining here is that because of Abu Ghraib, the United States is having a real serious discussion over what is appropriate and what isn't in terms of trying to get information from potential terrorists. It's a debate the country, I think, needs to have to work through what we think is appropriate in this new war we find ourselves in. In terms of how this might be reciprocated, it's sort of scary to contemplate that. When U.S. Servicemen or just Americans in general are captured overseas or held in the custody of another country, how can the United States point to its behavior as upstanding in light of what we've all seen coming out of Abu Ghraib?
Chris?
Well, the consequences of a handful of MPs who were operating without oversight and the negligence of the officers and non-commissioned officers that were appointed above them to make sure that this sort of thing didn't happen has been catastrophic to the cause. As far as how it affects the interrogators, and I hasten to add that although there's sort of been one interrogator who's been accused of doing something that was humiliating to a prisoner, and we must never countenance that, and I'm sure that she will be punished for having done that, and another interrogator, a couple or one or two, ought to have reported stuff that they saw, they're not directly involved in what happened there. But still, just by the proximity that we have, in fact, all soldiers, because we wear the uniform of our country and bear the same flag on our shoulder when we're on campaign, we all have to accept that this is that the consequences of this are going to be very, very far-reaching. I've heard that that the guys who were in the Abu Ghraib prison are called the six guys who lost the war. And, that's not entirely untrue. And the effect that it's going to have on interrogators is it's going to question people once used to consider the intelligence field as something that they'd want to get into. No doubt that they're going to reconsider that because of the negative press, deserved or undeserved in our particular case. And also, it's going to affect the sort of the creativity that people go into an interrogation to practice against a very ideologically steeled and very evil enemy. However, the scrutiny that the media has placed on this is a positive thing, because we have to above all make sure that the actions that soldiers take, in particular soldiers that take when they have the custody of enemy prisoners, is consistent with the values of our country and what we're trying to carry when we deploy our forces, the idea that we're trying to carry when we deploy our forces abroad.
So, Chris, you seem confident that what happened at Abu Ghraib was just the actions of a few individuals and not the result of a larger policy.
I can't entirely explain. You touched on it early in the interview. I can't entirely explain what the newspapers say was on the right side of that list of approved techniques, including the approved techniques that they had to seek higher authority to do. I could tell you from my own, and I don't mean to impugn the decisions that were made there, but on the surface, they do not seem consistent with the thinking that we had as a bunch of, junior people trying to do the best possible thing we could in the field and in the very early stages of this war. So I can't quite give a very good explanation of why they decided to allow those other techniques. I can tell you that interrogators that I've dealt with my entire life, if they stepped into an environment where that was permitted, they would have rejected that out of hand. And not just because it's the wrong to practice that type of humiliation, that type of intimidation and coercion on prisoners because they're people, but also because of the consequences of what would happen if you transgress these rules. I'm very surprised. I would be very, very surprised if an interrogator would do that, even if he was ordered to do it, because, as Nuremberg teaches us, I was following orders is no excuse.
Greg Miller, one last question for you. Mm-hmm. Chris Mackey feels, based on what he knows, he thinks that Abu Ghraib is the result of a few interrogators who did the wrong thing. That it's not, it's not policy. It's not system wide. Greg, you've been covering the story for the Los Angeles Times. From your point of view, are you as confident that it wasn't something more system wide?
My take on it to date, obviously not all of the information in, far from it, is that the abuses at Tier 1, the abuses that we see in those photographs, were carried out by a unit of MPs who were doing so in the middle of the night and according to their own statements that they've given to investigators, employing methods that they sort of imported from prisons where they worked in the United States. These MPs have also said that they were encouraged to do this by the intelligence troops. And I think there's probably some truth to that. I'm skeptical, I must say, that they were ordered to do certain things by intelligence troops. At least I would certainly hate to think that were the case. I also say because of these pictures, we've also had a new window into the interrogation methods that were being used at Abu Ghraib, which go well beyond what Chris was allowed to use when he was in Afghanistan. And that's something that's you could sort of see this sort of steady arc or this line from where Chris began into where things end up at Abu Ghraib in terms of the harshness of the methods that they were prepared to use. And if Abu Ghraib hadn't come to light, you wonder how long that trend line would have continued before something else would have happened. And the last point I would make is that it is beyond Abu Ghraib. There's no question that you've had two deaths at Bagram Air Base in December of 2002, months after Chris's unit left, that have yet to be explained by the Army. You have a number of cases of captives who were been held in custody by the CIA and who died in custody under mysterious circumstances, and we've seen charges brought in one of those cases now. And so it is a broader problem, and I think it's just part of the. One of the main themes of the book is that there is this constant tension in these facilities between doing the right thing, and getting as much information as you can, and those two things are at odds with one another. That's why it is such a potentially volatile mix.
Terry, there's one other thing that Greg alludes to in that comment, which is something that we didn't really face. The troops that are in Iraq are facing a very, very difficult situation with their mounting casualty lists. Every day, interrogators are confronted with another unit that hit a roadside bomb or another mortar attack that killed, troops from the 1st Cav. And, although there were casualties when we were in Afghanistan, and they were certainly a motivating factor for us to get the bottom of things to help the battlefield commander, we just didn't have this type of intense pressure that the troops over there face. And although I would say that that's never an excuse for transgressing the conventions, and if that does in fact turn out to be the case, it's certainly one interesting insight into why, certainly in the early days when I was in Afghanistan, the techniques remained as enlightened, if you will, if you can say that, then they may have been compared to things that took place afterwards.
We're out of time. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Chris Mackey is a former Army interrogator. Mackey is a pseudonym taken for security reasons. Greg Miller is a national security correspondent for the LA Times. Their new book is called The Interrogators. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews PJ Harvey's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Since her debut release in 1992, the British singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Polly Jean Harvey has established herself as a pop changeling, switching styles and images while maintaining a fierce seriousness, undercut occasionally by a mordant sense of humor that can only be characterized by the title of that debut album, Dry. PJ Harvey's new album, her seventh, is called Uh-Huh Her, and rock critic Ken Tucker says the British performer has achieved a maturity that isn't weighed down with self-seriousness.
Harvey has hit her mid-30s. She's no longer the cleverly morose young daughter of bohemian British parents, a girl who took pleasure in mashing together poetic lyricism and post-punk noise. It's been 4 years since her last album, the comparatively lush, romantic Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea. And on Uh-Huh, Her, Harvey seems to be more blunt and bitter. That song I just played, which opens the new album, compares a lover's words to poison. And by the third cut, she's slinging around the F word and some guitar squawk to express her extreme displeasure with the arrogance of someone she once cared about. Even a song as superficially pretty as this one, called The Pocket Knife, maintains a razor edge, in which she shoves a sharp shiv into the notion of settling down and marrying.
Please don't make my wedding dress.
Harvey recorded this album in her home and plays everything except the drums. She remains one of the most interesting guitarists in rock and roll, loose and savage, deceptively slapdash, and right in the groove established by her voice. Listen to the way she licks closed a kiss-off love letter. If you skip to the end of the album, you get to a song called The Darker Days of Me and Him, in which Harvey rattles off a wish list of a world with, quote, no neurosis, no psychosis, no psychoanalysis, no sadness. It's one of the rare moments in her career when she hasn't turned her disappointment or anger into a more worked-up piece of art, and it comes across as something other than raw, undercooked. Much more interesting and involving is a song such as It's You, about a young woman entering into a relationship she knows is a mistake, yet can't help herself.
Oh, dear sweet mama, I'm not feeling well. Can I step out for a little while? But I go missing, I steal away, and I go kissing.
There are times when Polly Jean Harvey can make miserableness sound like the most alluring mood in the world. She revitalizes the cliché about love being a blessing and a curse. And throughout Uh-Huh Her, she counts her blessings at extricating herself from bad love affairs, curses the men who brought her such unhappiness, and moves on to imagine new passions, new troubles, new retorts to people who think they know her, who look at her picture on the cover of this album and say, Uh-Huh, her. No, says Harvey throughout this album, you don't know me that well yet, and maybe you never will.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Uh-Huh, Her by P.J. Harvey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, love, you were the sickly child. You down, put on your spurs, swagger around in the desperate kingdom of love.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Flynn, author of the new book America the Vulnerable, How Our Government is Failing to Protect Us from Terrorism. Flynn was also the lead author of a report about vulnerabilities in Homeland Security released by a task force chaired by former Senators Gary Hart and Warren Rudman. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.